I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. A puppy mill law was passed a few years ago in Pennsylvania after it earned the reputation as being the puppy mill capital of the East. A critical report by the Dog Law Advisory Board and the Auditor General criticized the Corbett administration for not being aggressive enough in enforcing the law. Last year, the Dog Law Enforcement Office increased the number of citations and inspections. There are many fewer commercial kennels operating in the Commonwealth, but the office still has some work to do. Kristen Donmoyer is the state's new director of the Dog Law Enforcement Office. She has worked as a compliance specialist, a supervisor, and director of enforcement. And Kristen Donmoyer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also tweet us a picture of your dog at WHYY Radio Times. Kristen, is Pennsylvania still the puppy mill capital of the East?
No, Marty, I don't believe it is. In Pennsylvania, we have the strictest laws in the nation for kennel regulations. We have less than 60 commercial kennels currently in the state. And the three-quarters of the kennels that we have are boarding kennels, private breeding kennels, pet shop kennels, and rescue-type kennels.
I know when you worked as an inspector, you visited some of these puppy mills. And not to belabor this, but I want to make sure people understand what the problem certainly was. Help us understand some of what you observed as you were inspecting some of these frankly, pretty terrible kennels.
When I started in 2007, it was at the height of the changes with the dog law, going from no major class differences between a kennel that's high volume breeding and wholesaling versus a kennel that is a private breeding kennel. A lot of the regulations that came out with the changes in the dog law were due, in fact, to things that I saw and my coworkers saw when we started in 2007, issues with lighting, having dogs on wire flooring, having no unfettered exercise areas, having no real ventilation temperature requirements, and a lot of the commercial requirements that you'll see today are due in part to that. And the commercial kennels now have come a long way. They have certifications done by professional engineers. Most of them have air conditioning systems, solid flooring. The dogs have access to go outside and exercise at will.
I was reading some testimony you gave, a kennel that was closed down called Almost Heaven Kennel.
Yes. That kennel is the kennel that we actually partnered with the Pennsylvania SPCA on. They, unfortunately, dog law cannot handle animal cruelty cases. When we see cruelty, we have to actually call the humane officers and give them enough information to then obtain a search warrant to go on the property to look for animal cruelty and potentially seize any dogs. That particular case was a case with a lot of dogs being overbred, a lot of sickly dogs, sanitation issues, some of the worst ventilation I've ever experienced in kennels that I've visited over the years.
You mentioned the fact that, and I think there were something like 300 commercial kennels. Now there's something like 59 or 60 of them. To be a commercial kennel, how many dogs would be part of a kennel over a year's period of time?
To be a commercial kennel, there's one of two ways. You either breed and sell more than 60 dogs in a full calendar year, or you sell any dog wholesale. So if you sell one dog at wholesale, you will be a commercial kennel. So that's the key. It's breeding and selling, how many you sell, and then to whom you sell dogs to. Makes the difference between a commercial kennel and a private kennel.
And a commercial kennel is one that would be inspected and has to abide by the dog law regulations?
That is correct. Every state-licensed kennel, we have almost 2,300 state-licensed kennels, they all must be inspected twice per year. If our wardens go out, inspect, and find any violations, we automatically will do a reinspection. Any tips that come in or complaints that our office receives about a kennel, we will go out, and that'll prompt an inspection. We also have a state-licensed veterinarian on our staff that accompanies us to inspections. She's been in all of the commercial kennels as well. Commercial kennels are also a little different. There are strict requirements on commercial kennels as far as veterinary examinations are concerned. All the dogs must be seen by a vet every 6 months, and they must keep detailed veterinary records on hand at all times.
And you talk about the wholesale sale of a dog. What does that mean?
Wholesaling would be selling to another individual for resale. Typically, that would be the dogs that get sold to pet stores, and then pet stores are then selling them to the general public.
So if a single dog comes out of a commercial kennel sold to a pet store, that kennel has to be inspected?
That kennel would be considered as a commercial kennel. To fit the definition of being a kennel, one needs to have 26 or more dogs in a full calendar year. So it's not 26 dogs at one time. You could have 10 dogs, sell all 10 dogs, get another 10 dogs, sell those 10 dogs, get another 10 dogs, and then you hit 30. And at that point, you would need a kennel license.
Are there still illegal kennels in Pennsylvania?
There are. Unfortunately, there are a lot of underground kennel operations. That's one of the most pressing concerns for me, just because there are no regulations. We have no ability to check on the health and well-being of these dogs, no sanitation or maintenance requirements. What our office does is we have two individuals that will look specifically on the internet, Facebook sites, websites for advertising to search out and find these underground operations, because we want to ensure that dogs coming out of there are safe for the public. Consumers are purchasing these dogs and they're not getting guarantees of good health, which is a requirement under the Puppy Lemon Law. And they're coming to our office then, and of course we have to tell them, you know, they're not a licensed kennel. The public needs to be looking at, when they're purchasing a dog, are they a licensed kennel? What are their standings? We have a website, www.licensedyourdogpa.com. We maintain an entire kennel database where you can search a kennel that you're looking at adopting or purchasing a dog from and see their entire kennel inspection history. Those are the kind of things that individuals need to be looking at. If you go to one of these underground kennel operations, they're not likely going to show you the parents of the dog that you're looking at purchasing, tell you where the dogs came from, whether or not they came from another source or were bred on the site. So that is something major that our office is looking at. We are always searching. We rely heavily on tips from the public to go after these individuals.
Is there a certain part of the state where you're more likely to see some of these illegal kennels, or are they scattered across the Commonwealth?
They're actually scattered all over the state. Some of them work together, and you even see dogs coming in from out of state. A lot of times we monitor social media sites, because you can watch different groups bringing dogs in from out of state and where those dogs end up and which kennels they're working with. So we patrol the social media a lot.
Do you have enough staff to do what you think needs to be done?
I believe we do. We have a dog warden covering every county in the state, and then in addition to that, we have a kennel compliance specialist. We're adding a second kennel compliance specialist, so we'll be starting here in the next couple of weeks. And we also have a dedicated veterinarian that goes out with us.
You mentioned the Puppy Lemon Law. What is that law?
The Puppy Lemon Law is actually under the Office of Attorney General. And what that does is, every dog that is sold in Pennsylvania, the seller must give what we call a health certificate or a guarantee of good health to the purchaser. And that just outlines if there are any hereditary issues, what steps the purchaser must take, and what steps the seller has to follow in order to, whether it's, I just had a case where a dog had mange, and the lady did not get a guarantee of good health, that's a breach of contract, because what they could have done is went back and got part of the veterinary bill paid for, or had been able to return the dog. A lot of sellers have in their contracts that they will take the dog back. That's part of the lemon law. There's different options. I don't want to talk too much about a law that is not ours to enforce.
It's interesting, though. You have a legal background. Is that right?
I have a criminal justice background.
A criminal justice background, which is, I mean, that you bring a kind of this criminal justice background to the idea of dog law enforcement.
Correct. Coming from the law enforcement background, it's been my goal with the office to make sure that we are enforcing all provisions of the Act, all provisions with regards to the kennels, issuing summary citations when warranted, or taking steps to go the civil route where we can issue civil penalties. Depending on types of violations, sometimes it's better to go the civil route if it's a situation where it may just be wood that is unsealed. A citation that a court may look at as a minor infraction, but for our office, we take it seriously. And if a kennel owner does not come into compliance with that, they can receive a fine of $100 to $500 per day for that violation. So the fines can go up when you take the civil route. We're also, our office is working with dangerous dogs, working on making sure that every dangerous dog is registered in the state. Our office receives $500 annually for dangerous dog registrations, and we want to make sure that anybody that is harboring a dangerous dog has the dog registered, and then we follow up with inspections to ensure that they're keeping the dog in an adequate enclosure, and they're keeping up with having the dog licensed, current rabies vaccinations. We're also getting ready to start our 2014 licensing campaign. Next week, Governor Corbett will be in Pittsburgh at Animal Friends Shelter to proclaim March as License Your Dog Awareness Month. And then we follow that up with our Department of Agriculture, Secretary Greg. He goes around the state to different shelters to promote licensing through an event with the County Treasurer's Office. It's really important that we get awareness out to the public about dog licensing, because we have a huge stray epidemic in Pennsylvania. Not every county has a dog shelter.
Sure.
And what happens is our dog wardens and the police go out and pick up a stray dog, and then we end up having to take that stray dog five counties away. There's no way the dog's going to be reunited with its owner.
Well, Kristen Donmoyer, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times, the state's new director of the Dog Law Enforcement Office. More about dogs after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Widener University. Widener University offers over 60 graduate degree programs, including physical therapy, which combines classwork with hands-on learning in one of the nation's first student-led pro bono physical therapy clinics. Widener University is hosting a graduate open house on March 11th from 5 to 7 p.m. That's March 11th from 5 to 7 p.m. Registration is available now at widener.edu/leadership. That's widener.edu/leadership. Widener Leadership works.
Abington Health supports WHYY. Abington offers specialized care to help improve symptoms of heart failure. Physicians are using technology such as LVAD that involves attaching a pump directly to the heart. The LVAD pushes blood through the body at the same rate as a healthy heart. The program is designed to improve and maintain heart function, reduce hospital visits, and ensure a seamless continuum of care. Details online at abingtonhealth.org/CHF.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University President's Speaker Series presents An Evening with Cokie Roberts, Friday, March 7th at 8 p.m. on the Westchester University campus. Roberts is a political commentator for ABC News and senior news analyst for National Public Radio. In her more than 40 years in broadcasting, she has won countless awards, including 3 Emmys. For tickets and more information on the event, wcupa.edu/wculive.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Humans and dogs have a unique bond in the animal kingdom. And while we may view dogs as our best friends who can intuit our every thought and feeling, do we really understand how they see us? There's been some exciting research into canine cognition that is helping to answer that question. Daniel Mills, our guest, is a specialist in clinical animal behavior, also professor of veterinary behavioral medicine at the University of Lincoln in the UK. And tomorrow he's conducting a seminar at the Penn Vet Working Dog Center from 1 to 6, organized by the Penn Vet Lab, Penn Vet Behavior Group and the Working Dog Center. And Daniel Mills joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-7949, and you can tweet us a picture of your dog at WHYY Radio Times. So do dogs think of us as a friend?
Yeah, I think so. You know, as we sort of study more about dogs, the more we realize how complex the social relationships are. And I think, you know, we've got to be careful as a scientist talking about friendships, but actually it's probably the best way to describe it so people understand what it is. They have friends, they have people that they want to avoid as well, and other dogs too.
Well, and because it's so easy to project onto dogs because they seem so empathetic, you know, our own projections of what we think they're thinking about us.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an interesting thing because clearly dogs are very in tune with our emotions, and we've done quite a lot of work looking into that. But it's interesting when you start to look at how dogs actually think about things. That's where they tend to struggle much more. So they seem to respond to us without necessarily understanding us. But as I said, they're very sensitive to the emotions, but sort of understanding what we're thinking, it's much harder for them.
Well, and which is so interesting because some of your research has looked at how dogs look at the human face and how they read our emotions. And part of your research told me some things I didn't know about human emotions, which is that there's the left and the right side of the face and sort of expressing different things about how we're feeling at the moment.
Yeah, so as people, we have what's known as a left gaze bias when we look at a face. We have a specialized part of the brain, which is actually in the right side of the brain, and it causes, when we see a face, we very quickly pick up that it's a face, and it causes a slight sort of bias in the way that we look at faces. And so we were interested in whether or not dogs could do this, and it's thought, you know, faces are very important to our world, and we have to be able to pick up, you know, distinguish real people from just objects in the world to sort it out. So we started to look to see whether or not dogs showed this. And sure enough, they did, even though they don't have this bit of the brain. And then we started to present the dogs with pictures with different emotional content. And we found that the dogs seemed to be classifying the faces very much by emotional content. So if it was a sort of angry or neutral face, they tend to have the left gaze bias. But if it was a happy face, they would have more of a right size bias. And what we think this reflects is actually sort of different activity in the brain. So the right side of the brain tends to deal with sort of more negative things in the world. You know, if you're one of these people who can't stand to see a piece of paper on the floor and you have to pick it up, that's your right side of your brain kicking in. Whereas the left side tends to deal with the more positive things. And it seems that dogs have this lateralization in their brain. And it's giving us new tools to try and understand sort of how dogs are feeling. So, you know, by looking at the differences in the activity, we can do this entirely non-invasively now. I mean,
you're just literally looking at the dog's eyes, right? Instead of where their gaze goes.
If they're looking at pictures, we can look to see where their eyes are going. We're now developing techniques using thermal imagery cameras because actually, as one side of the brain warms up, actually, you can sometimes detect that on the surface as well. So, you know, if you've got a dog that's curled up, you can see potentially whether it's curled up and happy or curled up and feeling a bit sorry for himself.
Hmm. But are you telling us that the dogs look at the human face the way us humans look at each other's faces?
Well, there's some important differences. As I said, they don't have the bit of the brain that we have for facial processing, but they seem to be very skilled at it. So it's quite demanding for them. We think it's probably more demanding for them than it is for humans, but they seem to be very skilled. And it may be something we've actually selected for in the dogs that they will cooperate with us. If you think about it, the well-behaved dog is actually not the obedient dog. You know, obedient dog does what we ask when we ask it. The well-behaved dog just fits in with us without us bothering to ask. And this may be something, you know, that we've selected for in dogs, that they just fit in with us. And so sort of they've developed the techniques to work out what we're going to do, and we often portray that in our emotions. So, you know, far from it being a very complex skill, reading emotions probably sort of occurred quite early on.
Well, and are we talking about the difference between fear, anger, sadness? I mean, just how subtle can you get with emotions? And sometimes they're conflicting emotions on a human's face.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something we're starting to look into. We hope to have a new project starting later this year where we will start to try and tease out whether or not dogs differentiate the emotions or whether it's just positive versus negative. In the early part of our research, what we found was that if you presented the dog with a neutral face, they classified it as a negative. And one of the psychologists I was working with, he was sort of saying, well, you know, that's why should they do that? Mm-hmm. I said, well, if you think about it from a dog's point of view, when do you ever see a neutral human face? It's probably a scary face to them. They're thinking, what's going on here? So, I mean, you get those little surprises. The other thing we found quite early on is that in humans, when you turn a face upside down, they lose this left gaze bias. If you present them with an image, it's what we call the facial inversion effect, because basically we pick up on a face because we're looking for two eyes and a mouth, that sort of thing. And if the dots are in the wrong order, then we can't do it. But with the dogs, they seem to maintain the left gaze bias even upside down. And again, sort of one of my psychology colleagues that I was working with, he said, well, that's really weird. And I said, well, you think about it from a dog's point of view, you have to read a human face upside down, because if you're lying on your back looking up, you're going to see it upside down, and you want to know if that person's angry or not.
Do we know if dogs look at each other that way?
Yeah, we've looked at dogs looking at dogs, and we're hoping to do some stuff looking at more breed variability, and they certainly seem to pick up on the emotion in dog faces as well. And that can be, you know, pretty important. Again, sort of the neutral dog face is quite hard, I think, for dogs to classify. But the we use images perhaps of, you know, the Labrador just before he's going to be fed as the happy dog image. And
we know that image.
And they certainly distinguish between those quite effectively.
But does this tell us about how dogs have been able to survive with humans, and also tell us about this, I think, really incredible bond between animals and human beings?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I do think dogs are special in that regard. Yes, we have a strong bond with a whole range of species, but, you know, dogs were the first animals to be domesticated, and their ability to pick up on our emotions, you know, is probably something that's been selected for, because, you know, for cooperative work, which is what dogs have really been selected for in the beginning, they have to be able to read our intentions. And, you know, we express a lot in our faces. And, you know, if you think about sort of you're going out hunting and you want a dog and you're trying to guide it and you're instruct it, then that attention to the face seems to be very important. And unlike wolves, you know, The research seems to show that with wolves, when they start to explore, they actually explore only with the sense of smell. Whereas with dogs, what's happened is they explore a little bit later, and as a result, they can use both vision and hearing when they're exploring new things. And that may be sort of the fundamental shift which allows them sort of later on in life to use many more visual cues in order to work out what's going on. And that attention to people is something clearly that we've selected for. But there are possibly breed differences. There's some good work that's been done in Australia which actually showed the length of the nose predicted the sort of inner structure of the eye. And that has important impact, because if you've got a long nose, you basically, the area that you can focus is like a narrow strip across the whole of your visual field. People may be familiar with horses.
Sure.
You know, they can scan horizons. Whereas if they've got a short nose, they have a focal spot like a human. So, you know, if you look at my face, you can see my face is in focus, but above, below, and to the sides isn't. And if you think about it, you think about the typical lapdog breeds, they're all pretty much short-nosed breeds. And it may be that we don't know whether we selected for dogs that could focus on our face or whether we selected for dogs with short noses because we find them cuter. And there's some great work being done looking at that, that, you know, as you shorten a dog's nose, actually we find it more endearing quite often.
It looks more like a baby,
yeah,
right, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's what we call the pedomorphic effect.
And what about when we say, oh, you said you're a good boy? I mean, what do we do with our dogs or girl? Do they respond to that?
Respond to that. We've done work looking at dogs' understanding of the emotional content of what we say, and they clearly can distinguish it. So we did some work quite a while ago now looking at the sort of emotional content of different commands. And, you know, every dog was its own individual, so we sort of used the dog's normal responses as the baseline, and then we looked at giving the commands either in a happy voice, a sad voice, or an angry voice. And what we found was that if you looked at the happy voice, then how they responded normally was a good predictor. But as soon as you started to be negative in your tone of voice, then the dog's behavior became much more variable.
And were they confused?
Well, we don't know exactly
worried?
What they... Yeah, we don't know exactly sort of why it was more variable, but it may be that it's harder to pick up. And we've done some other work which shows that sort of certainly if you put stuff before a command word, it does confuse the dog. So if you sigh, oh, sit down, you know, that makes it harder for the dog to pick up the word sit down. But also, you know, I think human behavior probably becomes more erratic if we're in a negative frame of mind. So
indeed it does.
Probably the dog is thinking, I'm not sure how to play this one quite, you know, I'm looking for the other cues as to whether I should do what I'm told or actually just keep my distance at this point.
Well, let me reintroduce you. This is our guest, Daniel Mills, a specialist in clinical animal behavior, professor of veterinary behavioral medicine at the University of Lincoln in the United Kingdom, joining us in this hour of Radio Times to talk about some of this fascinating new research about how dogs read human beings and this incredible bond between humans and dogs. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times and send us a picture of your dog as well. And many cute pictures are coming in. I wonder, though, whether we ask too much of dogs, broadly speaking. In many ways, you know, if you're a working family, you leave the dog alone for maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe more hours. They're on a leash outside because we have leash laws in this country about, you know, where you can take your dog. Are we asking too much of them to live in our world?
I think sometimes we are, and I think that's one of the reasons why this work is so important. That, you know, the more we can understand, the more we can understand what is acceptable. We deal with behavior problems in our clinic, and, you know, our job there is really to be an arbiter between the dog and the owner's interests. You know, you have to recognize compromises have to be made in any relationship, you know, whether it be with another human or whatever. And our job is to try and find sort of an acceptable compromise. But, yeah, I mean, social separation is a big issue for dogs. You know, we've bred dogs because we want them to be good partners, and by selecting for them to be sort of very attached to us, then to leave them for 9-10 hours
yes.
a day is a big ask.
Yes.
And you know, a lot of dogs really struggle with that. So, you know, we do need to start thinking sort of for smart solutions to try and find this. You know, there's dog walkers, etc., which can help out there, and those sorts of things. And really sort of try to identify what the risk factors are for those dogs that really do struggle to cope. Because it's been estimated that over 20% of dogs suffer from overt separation-related problems. And
wow.
The figure may be as high as 40% or more.
Which either sometimes they start tearing up the house or they're howling all day long, that
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's many reasons why dogs can do that. So, and I mean, obviously, there's some which you don't worry about as far as the dog's welfare is concerned. If the dog's just having fun, you still worry about if he's ruining
your kitchen or something
exactly.
like that.
But even sort of when we think about the dog sort of being in a negative frame of mind, some of our research is now really trying to pin down the different reasons emotionally why dogs will do that. So whilst the trigger is being left alone, it might be that, you know, the dog has a problem with actually the bond, and I can't cope without you. It might be I don't like being alone, which is different because it's sort of I don't mind being without you, I just don't like being alone, or
yeah.
I don't like being in this place because I have no control. If you think about it, if you're in a sort of a room and you've got no control over what goes on and there's a thunderstorm, think about it from a dog's point of view. There's these booms going all on around you and you've got no control over it. What are you supposed to do? So, so we're trying to do some work to try and tease this out, because if we can be more precise with our diagnosis, we can be more precise with the treatment and make the treatments easy, because there are good treatments out there, but they're quite complicated and demanding.
Figuring out what the diagnosis is. In fact, there's a Google I'll give to our listeners, a closer look at separation-related problems in the dog, and that's some of the research that you've been doing on separation anxiety.
That's a big survey that we're doing, and we're doing it internationally, so there will be a Japanese version, Spanish, Portuguese, etc., all going up fairly soon. It's a big questionnaire, but we do ask people to stick with it, because the depth of information that it will give us will hopefully, you know, allow us to really pin down the different forms of the reasons why dogs get distressed when they're left alone, to develop new and better treatments.
But what you're telling us is this is a really big problem.
It's a big, big welfare
for the
problem.
Dog and I guess for the person as well.
Yeah.
Let me get, looks like Janet from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Janet, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor Mills, I have a question. I've had a number of dogs, and when I walk down the street with them, they react very differently to different people, and especially I've been concerned when they begin to act and they're on a leash violently, or you know, they start barking crazily. What are they picking up?
There's lots of things they could be picking up on.
Thanks, Janet.
Certainly dogs can distinguish between different types of individuals. We know they can use just the sort of internal facial features to distinguish between people, so they can pick up on quite subtle differences. But if they've had a previous history where they've had a bad experience with someone, supposing, you know, they've not had much experience of people with beards, but then, you know, somebody with a beard goes and treads on their toes, then they might say, well, you know, what's different between these people? And they'll pick up on something like the beard and then perhaps generalize that to people with beards. It can be simple things like the style of people's walk as well. We've got some work that we're doing at the moment.
The gait, actually.
Yeah, the gait. They can, if it's slightly unusual, they might become more alert and a little bit more cautious. And if you're walking the dog and your dog suddenly seems to sort of become more alert, you might tighten the lead. Now, that can feed back on the dog itself as well. And this is one of the things that can lead to problems, that if you've got a dog that is reactive and you start to tense the lead, then the dog picks up on that, and then the dog thinks, well, you're nervous, I need to protect you, or something like that, and responds accordingly.
What do you suggest people do?
Well, I mean, people need to stay in control, absolutely. They don't want to, but they need to be relaxed. As we were saying earlier, you know, dogs are very in tune with people's emotions. So if you can stay relaxed but in control, and really make it a non-issue for the dog, then the dog will often just pick up on that and say, okay, it's not an issue for you, you know, and hopefully it will let it pass by.
Well, and just picking up on Janet's example, which is say, hey, how are you? I mean, that sort of just try to sort of lighten the scene.
Absolutely. It's a sort of, make it a non-event, make it a happy event. If there are people that you know that the dog responds to, then, you know, if it's safe and acceptable to do so, give them some treats and ask them just to toss the treats as they go by, actually. Not ask the dog to do something, actually. Just make it sort of, hey, when this person passes by, they give me some treats. That's a good thing. And, you know, actually those sort of unexpected surprises are much more powerful in building the relationships than getting the dog to sit and, you know, follow commands, because, you know, we don't have friends because we do what they tell us to.
Something to get, yes, no we don't. Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation again. Daniel Mills is our guest. He's a specialist in clinical animal behavior, professor of veterinary behavioral medicine at the University of Lincoln in the UK. And I should add that he's conducting a seminar tomorrow afternoon at the Penn Vet Working Dog Center. It's organized by the Penn Vet Behavior Group and the Working Dog Center. And of course, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and make sure you include a picture of your dog. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Allentown Symphony Orchestra presents Mozart's Requiem Saturday, March 8th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, March 9th at 3 p.m. Often referred to as his swan song, Mozart's final composition, Requiem, remains one of his most popular works. introducing the newly formed Allentown Symphony Chorus. Also, cellist Christine Lampria will be featured in Barber's Cello Concerto. Information at millersymphonyhall.org. The Allentown Symphony Orchestra proudly supports WHYY.
Do Russia's overtures in Ukraine get the U.S. out of China's way in Asia?
There is an opportunity for them to allow the United States to be distracted and look at Europe and not to continue this concept of a pivot to Asia.
Wither Russia and Asia with the U.S. distracted by Russia in Europe. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
CHF, the Chemical Heritage Foundation, supports WHYY. This evening, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., CHF welcomes Mary Seaton Corboy, head farmer at Philadelphia's Greens Grow Farms. Are cities still concrete jungles? This concept is being reconsidered in 21st century America. Information on how community gardens and urban farms are playing a growing role in the sustainability movement, bolstering foodie culture, and anchoring local food hubs. More information online at chemheritage.org/FirstFridays.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Daniel Mills, our guest, leading animal behaviorist. He is an authority on canine cognition and the relationship between dogs and humans. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You were telling us about some really interesting research about what people talk to their dogs about.
Yeah. One of the areas I'm increasingly interested in is the benefits that dogs bring to people. And, you know, if you look at most of the work at the moment, they sort of say, well, are you a dog owner, yes or no? And you think, well, we need to go beyond that because, you know, there's different types of dog owners. So we've been trying to characterize the relationship. And it's clearly one of the important dimensions is the degree of sort of social support that dogs bring us. But we've got a little bit of work going on at the moment where we're looking at sort of what people talk to their dogs about. And, you know, in human relationships, self-disclosure is quite an important area.
Yes.
to understand sort of if you feel you can confide in someone, then, you know, it makes you feel better, you can share it, etc. So we're asking people to fill in a questionnaire whereby they sort of say the sorts of things they will talk to their dog about versus their partner. And, it's throwing up some interesting results, and there's clearly some quite strong differences. At the moment, most of our respondents tend to be female, and they tend to be heterosexual relationships, but we really want to find sort of everybody, if there are differences and what people are chatting about. Because, certainly, you know, when people are sad, they seem to be much more willing to chat to their dog than their partner.
Well, that's fascinating. But does the dog, because the dogs seem to have this, I don't know if empathy is exactly the right word, but does that make the dog sad when we share our sad experiences with them?
I don't know that it makes them sad. I think it probably brings a closeness. And it's interesting. Just the other week, a friend of mine, she gave a seminar back in England, and she was looking at dogs' faces. And what she found was she was trying to see sort of what factors about dogs' faces encourage people to actually adopt them. And she looked at a whole range of expressions, and she found that only one expression seemed to increase the chance of a dog being adopted. It was if the dog could lift one eyebrow.
Oh.
And those dogs that could lift one eyebrow were much more likely to be adopted. You know, and you think about it, when you confide and you're close to the dogs, you often see them just lift that sort of knowing eyebrow. And I don't know what's going on in the dog's mind at that point, but it's something that really tunes into us, I think. And, you know, they're uncritical friends. I mean, we also have quite a lot of work going on dogs with families with a child with autism. And one of the things where the dog seems to really be helpful is not only with the parent, and we saw a very, very big effect on the parent as well as the child. But, you know, the world's a scary place, I think, if you've got autism. And, you know, having a dog that you can confide in and that is going to be non-critical is, you know, really quite important and gives a lot of support. So there's quite a lot of programs starting to develop also, you know, both in the US and the UK with reading to dogs programs to get children to be more literate. Because, again, if the dog's there, they're non-critical. If they're struggling with words, you know, they've got the dog there and they want to tell the story. And, you know, words like dog and cat are amongst the first words that kids start to use as well.
True.
So if we can use them to sort of emphasize the benefit and, you know, capitalize on that benefit, you know, I think society's a lot better place.
Let me get Catherine from Landenberg to join our conversation. And Catherine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have two dogs, Brat Terrier and a Jack Russell Terrier, 5 and 7 years old, and I also just have two new children, both under 3. My daughter is 1, and she has some medical needs due to congenital heart disease. Mm. And my question is, my dogs are very friendly with the kids, to the point of being overly needy, and the male dog has started marking my home because he's so jealous. Because of my daughter's medical needs, I can't really prioritize the dogs like we used to, so they've taken more of a peripheral role. Is there anything I can do to help them with their jealousy issues of the children, plus keep my dog from urinating in my home?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Go ahead, Dan.
I mean, there is potentially a lot that can be done, but I really would be quite cautious about giving direct advice on such a complex problem, especially with young children. And if you think that the dogs are being jealous, then, you know, there are potential risks there. But are you in the local area? Because, you know, PenVet do offer a referral service for people, and it's the sort of thing that would, you know, I really would encourage you to seek referral to Dr. Syracuse there, who runs the behaviour referral service, and he'll be able to talk through the whole range of issues with you. You know, typically our consultations are about 2 to 3 hours. I don't know how long they are here, but, you know, it's an extensive thing. It is a potentially serious issue, and, you know, you want to sort of act now. I think that's the best advice I can give at this time, really.
And I think that's actually good advice. Catherine, good luck with that, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Daniel, we have an email from Jill. Oh, my God, what is it with dogs and the mailman?
There's several things with the mailman, I think. You know, especially, I mean, if you've got a dog and the mailman comes, you know, and the dog's left alone, hey, there's something happening. So that could be exciting. The dog barks, mailman does something, and then dog keeps barking, mailman disappears. So actually, you know what? I find the dog learns that barking seems to send the mailman away. The dog doesn't realize that he's going anyway. And so they get into this habit. And it can be quite spectacular, the damage they can do to your front door.
Yeah. Well, when I had our dog, our male woman always put a little biscuit in there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's, you know, and they became really best friends.
Yeah. You know, a lot of dogs that are reactive to the mailman are not sort of, they don't hate the mailman. It's just excitement. But, you know, they can learn to hate the mailman if sort of people start punishing them and sort of telling the dog to shut up, because then they now learn that the mailman predicts the owner seemed to be horrible to me, you know, so I don't want that mailman anywhere near me, which actually means that the dog now preemptively looks out for the mailman as well, which makes the problem even worse. And that's why, you know, understanding dogs and how they think about things is so important, because we look at things in one way and we think, you know, we don't realize that we may well be contributing to the problem.
Well, you're talking about cause and effect, I mean, but also dogs as problem solvers.
Yeah, absolutely. Dogs are good problem solvers. And, you know, we use dogs an awful lot. And I know people increasingly, you know, want to find high-tech solutions. But for some of the things, you know, medical detection dogs, you know, dogs can pick out different types of cancer, help people with diabetes as well. And, you know, we use them sort of for military purposes to detect explosives, and working dogs as well. So, you know, they are enormous, and they're enormously resourceful. And, you know, the thing they retain is that flexibility. I think that's really important, that we sort of make the best use of that.
Let me get Scott from Maniac to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a professional dog walker, and so I see usually about 10 clients a day, and most of them are dogs whose, you know, human owners are away at work for a long time. So I get to see a lot of different behaviors, and it seems to me, I was just wondering, have you done any research on, like, whether they respond to hand signals better than voice commands?
Yeah, we have, actually.
In my experience, they focus on your hand more than your face.
Yeah,
that's where the food comes from.
Thanks, Scott.
They do, and we've actually done that very experiment in a variety of different settings. Basically, we've taught the dog both a verbal and a visual signal, for example, to go left or right. And you know, you point left, you say left, and you point right, you say right. And then you put them in conflict, so you point left and say right, or you point right and say left. And what is interesting is, yeah, the vast majority of dogs go with the visual signal, but consistently in our work, we found that about 10% go with the verbal. So again, you know, and I think this is a really important thing, you know, often as a scientist you're interested in what's happening in populations. So you say, oh, look, dogs obey the visual over the verbal sign. But actually, you know, because I work with clinical behaviour, I'm interested in what makes individuals' differences. And, you know, it suggests that 10% of dogs actually prefer to attend to the sort of what we're saying. And I think it's important that we recognise that individual dogs need individual solutions.
Well, and Scott, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And in many ways, it sounds like what a dog needs is also what a child needs, which is consistency, clarity, you know, the ability to communicate directly,
yeah, absolutely.
Formally.
Yeah, I think, you know, consistency is important. The other thing I think that's really quite important to dogs is that they have a degree of control, you know, that they're not there to be servants entirely, that, you know, they're members of the family. Most people, you know, treat them as members of the family. And so we have to be able to give the dog the chance to have a little bit of its own space. You know, we all like our own sort of time to ourselves, and we have to make sure that the dog can do that as well. And that can actually alleviate a whole range of problems by teaching the dog what we call a safe haven. You know, this is a place where you go, and if you go there, I respect that you're there. And, you know, the important thing is everybody in the house has to understand that rule. So you set up an area, and you get the dog to relax there. You don't interfere with it. You don't feed him there. You just sort of perhaps toss some treats when he's not there, so he goes there and he finds them. And this is an area where he likes to hang out.
Huh.
And if you want to take him for a walk, you can ask him, "Do you want to go for a walk?" And if he says no, you respect that. You just go for a walk without him. And this actually gives the dog, you know, that way of being able to distance himself, because, you know, our homes can be stressful at times. We've got sort of visitors we weren't expecting, and, you know, people might be a lot of noise and stuff. The dog can just take himself off, and he knows that no harm will happen to him there. And that really helps him cope an awful lot. And as long as everybody respects that, mm-hmm. then actually, you know, dogs can put up with an awful lot.
Do dogs like sleeping with people? I was thinking about that yeah. sort of separate private space.
Yeah. No, I some dogs do, some dogs don't. You know, and I think it's important. I mean, people sometimes say, oh, you know, you shouldn't let the dog sleep with you. It'll get over-attached. It's probably not sleeping with you that's sort of triggering the sort of attachment-related problems. It's more a question of sort of perhaps some of the other indulgences that we do with the dogs. We might make the dog needy. They're sort of the bigger risk than sort of just sleeping with the dog. You know, if it's a cold night and it's been pretty cold in the city recently, then you might want to snuggle up with your dog.
Fair enough. Let me get Kit from East Falls to join our conversation. Hi, Kit. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi,
great show. Makes me want to get a dog.
Indeed.
Here's my question. Since dogs have such an incredible sense of smell, can they detect human emotions by scent?
Thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Again, it's something that we have looked at least at a preliminary level. We basically got some students who were about to do a presentation and put sort of some swabs on their hands and looked to see whether or not the dogs could discriminate between them. And it looks like maybe sort of, yeah, changes in our sweat they may be able to pick up on. When we're distressed, but, you know, we haven't done sort of the full controls whether or not they'd be able to discriminate, you know, somebody being nervous from somebody being really excited, and the sweat that we produce in that situation, then it's quite possible. But, you know, dogs, yeah, do have an incredible sense of smell. You know, they can outperform, you know, the best machines. Yeah. Still,
Kit, thanks for the call. Let's get Susan from Logan Township, New Jersey, to join us. Hi, Susan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
I'm loving this conversation, and actually, while I've been listening to you, not only have I learned so much, but I've changed my question, if that's okay.
Well, just make it snappy, Susan, but
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. I have two little rescue dogs. I got the first from the shelter, and he was always trying to play with other dogs, so I thought the best thing to do was to get him another dog. But I recognized that all dogs don't like all dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So we had four little dogs come and spend the night with us from different rescue groups. And the fourth one was the hit. He absolutely loved her, and she is now our second dog. She's a puppy mill breeder dog.
Uh-huh.
And she constantly looks at our faces. It just goes to, you know, it's so much what you were saying earlier.
Mm-hmm.
She looks at our faces to take her cues from us.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if my dog picked her because he knew of her past life.
Well, Susan, let me see what our guest Daniel Mills has to say.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, as I said, we recognize that the relationships are more complex than, you know, perhaps the traditional ways that people have looked at it. And we have individual preferences. We don't know much about the things that we pick up on those individual preferences. You know, you could meet a stranger and you could suddenly sort of fall in love with them. And it may be that there's a chemistry there. And the same may be true, you know, between dogs as well.
Susan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We could do a whole hour on this, but let me ask you about what is described as breed-specific legislation, the idea that there are certain bad breeds. What's your position on that?
It's something which, I find very sad because certainly in the UK we have legislation that is breed-specific. And, you know, to me it's there's a whole range of problems with it. First of all, you know, there's good and bad in everything. And a number of years ago we did a big TV program, and what we found was that we asked people to fill in the questions, do some tests with their dogs and complete some stuff online, some simple tests. And we got 27,000 people to take part. You know, this is a big study. And so we could actually look at this in more detail. And yeah, there were small differences between breeds in sort of some of their cognitive abilities, but the variation within a breed always swamps the variation between. To put it crudely, you know, my attitude is if you don't believe in racism, you shouldn't believe in breedism.
Oh.
It's as simple as that. You know, there's good and bad. And, you know, we need to recognize the individuals and the effects of the environment that they have. There is a cultural phenomenon associated with certain breeds having certain problems. And there are sort of perhaps on average behavior differences. But, you know, I have a real problem with it. You know, I think, you know, we need to be encouraging responsible dog ownership, not just legislating against dogs on the basis of what they look like.
Well, we could go on. It's been fascinating. Daniel Mills, thank you very much for joining us
you're
today
welcome.
In Radio Times.
Thank
and
you.
Again, you're very welcome. Professor of Veterinary Behavioral Medicine at the University of Lincoln in the United Kingdom. And he's giving a seminar tomorrow afternoon at the Penn Vet Working Dog Center, again, organized by the Penn Vet Behavior Group and the Working Dog Center. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, and keep sending those pictures of your dog, tweet them at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.